Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. This is the 56th episode of the podcast. And for this edition, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow.
Yeah, it's been a while. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. We're going to be talking about practice. That's right. We're talking about practice. We're going to be talking about exhibition games, real and fictional, recruiting. Man, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. I just wanted to say before we start real fast that I thought it was that been a lot of media coverage about it, but I thought it was really cool what X and the basketball program did on Sunday for Mount St. Joe's and Lauryn Hill. They showed some of the highlights at the Bengals-Jags game, which I was at, which was really awesome. And I thought it was cool. Like, one thing I didn't realize is that a lot of people, like arena staff, ticket takers, ushers, all those people, they just donated their time. I mean, they showed up and worked that game, and just a lot of people chipped in to make that a really cool experience for her. So I thought that was really good, and it you know, it looked great for Xavier. Obviously, it's not something they did for PR purposes, but it was kind of nice to hear Coach Mac, really Jim well. Rome show and see all the highlights of the floor, you know, the game being at CentOS Center on Sports Center. It was just really cool, and as the season ticket older, it made me feel a little warmth in my freezing heart to be associated with a program that would do something like that. So that's probably the last nice thing I'll say during this podcast.
And we're going to talk about that more with Shannon Russell. She's our special guest tonight. She's going to be coming on the podcast at the end. So we'll talk about that because she was actually at the game and covered it. And I do want to say now, because I didn't want to kind of like ruin the moment on Twitter. I felt like it probably would have been inappropriate then. But like, because of the people that I follow, I had my Twitter timeline was like straight all these really great, like just awesome emotional tweets about Lauryn Hill, mixed with angry Bengals Twitter, getting pissed off about Andy Dalton, who was just blowing things at the moment. So my timeline was just an absolute wreck on Sunday of emotions. But there you go. That's all.
I consciously tried not to be a miserable person during the Bengals game when I was
it's impossible.
But like, well, my basic problem is like the guy behind me keeps saying like, I know it's not smart, but I'm a risk taker. I'd go for it on 4th-and-12 from my own 16.
Hey, like, it works in Madden, bro.
Yeah, I mean, like, why do the dumbest people at Bengals games talk the most?
They just sit behind you. That's the best part.
Snow, I don't think that's restricted to Bengals games. I think that's an epidemic in all of American society. But anyway, I guess the first thing we wanted to hit on, guys, is to talk about an event that occurred shortly after the last podcast, which was Kaiser Gates' commitment to XU. As I recall where we left it, we had talked about the sort of 180, Rick, that occurred with Kipper Nichols, where it looked like things were getting close to a commitment on that front. And then there was a parting of the ways at the last second. So when you look at Kaiser Gates, when you talk about Kaiser Gates, what kind of a player is X getting? And how did you what was your sense of how this recruitment went down after the Nichols situation fell apart?
Well, I mean, I guess this is kind of why you go in the direction of we're completely shifting. You know, we're not recruiting Kipper Nichols at all anymore. And you make it clear that Kaiser Gates is priority because they were able to lock him up pretty quickly after that. And that's also why I think they felt that they could put an ultimatum on Kipper Nichols and say, you need to commit or you're kind of going to lose that spot, because they knew Kaiser Gates liked X and they were building a pretty good relationship with the kid. And, you know, it's a nice get for Mike Pegues and the staff. The biggest thing about Kaiser Gates and the biggest difference between him and Kippers is obviously his skill. We talked about that on the last podcast. He's a guy who can really shoot it from the outside. That's probably the best part of his game. And again, I hate doing this, but I've said it a lot of times. I think he's very similar to Justin Martin when in terms of his game. And then when you sort of look at what he has to improve on and why he's not ranked a little higher, it kind of also is in line with Justin Martin, because he doesn't always have a consistent motor, and he tends to fade at times and space out a little bit on the court. But when he's locked in and when he's playing with effort, I think he's a really talented offensive player.
Snow, yeah, your thoughts on Kaiser Gates?
Yeah, lines up mostly with Rick. I mean, I don't think anyone's expecting him to come in and be a freshman All-American, and he's going to come in and compete for playing time at a position that is going to be interesting. I mean, Jalen Reynolds, I mean, I don't see him going to to the NBA after this year, clearly, but I think he's going to be a very good player. So then you're looking at Mackinday London probably after a redshirt year, though that hasn't been determined yet. Kaiser Gates at the four, because Trayvon Blewett might be the best player on the team right now, and he's playing at three. So, you know, he's going to come in, he's going to have to compete. But I think if there's one thing that's clear, it's that the Xavier coaching staff listens to this podcast and takes Dan's opinion very, very seriously, because Dan has been railing about the lack of 3-point shooting for the last couple years. And seemingly every player they've recruited since Dan went on his rant has been a 3-point shooter. So I think, Dan, you are changing the program.
I'm the real MVP.
You're the real MVP, clearly. I'm the
real MVP.
So, Rick, when you look at this as far as a general direction for the staff, Snow mentioned my obvious priority to get more shooters. But it seems like X is going after a lot of guys that seem capable of playing different positions, that have a lot of versatility in their game. Can you talk a little bit about some of the guys they've added that fit that profile?
Well, yeah, I think one of the things about the direction they're headed is they found out, like you were sort of talking about, Dan, they found out offense is a lot easier no matter what offense you're running if guys can make shots. And when they haven't had guys who can make shots on the court the last couple of years, they saw how easily some teams could take your whole offense away, even if you had a great point guard like a Tu Holloway or a Samaje Christen who could seemingly get to the rim at will. If there was a defender who was long and could stop them and they couldn't shoot the ball from the outside and you didn't have other shooters for them to kick to, you really had trouble scoring the ball in certain games. And a lot of times those ended up being big games that you couldn't win. So I think that's sort of why they've decided to go this direction of looking for more skilled players and adding shooters to the roster. And I think, you know, you sort of look at a team like Villanova and you had to play against them last year. And it's like, well, they don't necessarily have like a Javon Pinkston who's really, really good, but they don't necessarily have to play with a traditional four, a traditional five, a traditional three. They're just playing a lot of 6-7 guys from one to four and then a really tough dude inside. And they're hard to guard and they run a lot of good stuff. So I think that's what Xavier's kind of realized is make the other teams guard you. Get the best offensive players you can. You obviously still have to have some tough defensive minded guys, and they have those as well. But I think they've just realized as the past few years have gone on that they need shooters, and it makes their system a lot easier to coach on offense.
Yeah, I think another thing is, and you're seeing it, when Chris first got the job, you'll remember they lost to Kansas State twice that season. Once when they got absolutely annihilated in Manhattan, and then in the infamous Dante Jackson don't go under the screen game, stay attached, so Jacob Pullen can't hit a three. But what they saw with Kansas State was how big those guys were, whether it was Curtis Kelly. I can't remember who all Kansas State had down low, but they had like 4'5", 6'9", 6'10" guys. And Xavier was jealous of that. And now you look at the roster and it's about that point where they started changing their recruiting a little bit, like, man, we want to be like Kansas State. Stainbrook, huge. Farr, huge. Reynolds, huge. Mackinday London, not necessarily huge, but 6'10", 6'11". O'Mara, huge. I mean, that this Xavier team's going to look a lot like that Kansas State team, at least physically. And now they're copycatting Villanova a little bit, too, with the multiple positions, versatility. This is what we want. Guys can beat you inside and out. And I think they're trying to come up with the best of both worlds in what they've hated to coach against.
Well, and that's interesting you bring that up, Brian, because that I wanted to move on and talk a little bit about what we've seen so far in practice and then in the hypothetical basketball game that may or may not have occurred. And the big takeaways for me from watching practice are that this team, first of all, what you just said, this team is huge, and not just because they have a bunch of gigantic big men, but also Trayvon Blewett is a physically imposing dude at the three. Edmund Sumner, when he's able to come back, is a really big, long guard. I feel like there's a lot of guys on this team that bring more size and athleticism and length than they've had in the last couple of years. The other thing, obviously, that jumps out when you look at this team is the increase in their ability to shoot the jump shot up and down the roster. When you think about last year's team, you had Dee Davis and Justin Martin, two guys that could shoot threes but didn't take a lot of them, and they usually shoot a respectable percentage. They hope to have Miles Davis as a specialist off the bench. He just had a miserable slump for most of the year, and they really didn't get any three-point production out of anyone else. A lot of times they might only have one.
Well, far a little bit early.
Yeah, a little bit early, but once you got into once you got into Big East play, a lot of times this team had two guys on the floor at a given time who would even take a three,
right?
Let alone hit it. This year, you've got Trayvon and JP, who are both outstanding three-point shooters. You've got Miles back. Hopefully, he gets out of his slump this year. You've still got D, but it just seems like they have a lot more guys on the, and even Jalen Reynolds can step out to 15 feet. He can stretch it a little bit more than Isaiah was willing to last year. Far, as you talk about, is a guy that can be a pick and pop threat. I feel like the team shoots a lot better. And I remember one particular drill at the practice the three of us were at, where X was running basically a two times up and down the floor in a 4-on-4 drill, and I believe they hit four threes. Every possession ended with a made three, which is something that last year you would have never seen. There probably is a better chance of four different spectators getting hit by jump shots clanging off the rim. So I think that those are the two biggest changes the two biggest takeaways when you see the team practice is the size up and down the roster and the fact that they just have more guys that can shoot.
And I think the positional size is a big thing. Like you mentioned, it's not just you've got Stainbrook and Reynolds and Farr and Amara. It's that you've got six guys that are thick like Trayvon Blewett at the three. You've got a 6'5 JP McCure at the two and the three. You've got a 6'4, maybe even 6'5 now, Edmund Sumner at the one and the two. And even like a guy like Larry Austin is tough, you know, physically strong and gets after it defensively. It just makes the court feel so much smaller defensively, and especially when you're rebounding. And one of the things about Trayvon Blewett, and we'll talk about these guys individually in a moment, but one thing about Trayvon Blewett is I don't think fans are going to, they're expecting a lot of him offensively. I don't think they realize how well he's going to rebound the basketball. That might be his most impressive trait right now as a freshman, is how well he rebounds from the wing position.
That was going to be our next sort of thing, as we were going to just sort of run down the roster real quickly, maybe just some quick takes from each of us about each player, and I just sort of closing the loop and bringing us up to speed. This may also include some hypothetical discussion of the game between St. Francis of Ohio and Neff College of Cleveland that may or may not have been played at a local arena on Saturday. So, gentlemen, let's start with Matt Stainbrook, as Rick was calling him at practice, the lost Gasol brother.
There's not a lot to say about Stainbrook. He kind of just does his thing. He hasn't really taken on much of a leadership role as far as getting after guys in practice. He does more of his work one-on-one. Like when he's banging against a big and working him in the post, he might talk to that guy after that specific play and give him some encouragement there, or he might help an individual guy throughout a drill, but he's not like a real team-oriented, rah-rah, get-everyone-together guy. And if you read that Xavier Nation magazine that just came out, he talks about that in there, where he kind of sees it more as a job, and he's kind of off in his own world, just focused on what he's doing. And like, honestly, he's kind of like the old grumpy man at practice, just kind of frustrated with all these young guys banging into him, like Jalen Reynolds, who's dunking every 5 seconds and knocking into Matt's old knees. But Matt's just so good. I mean, you know what to expect out of him. He's consistent every day. He's maybe the best passer on the team after D. Davis. He's skilled offensively on the block, and he's a load on the glass. And I think he's going to have an even better year than he had last year, although they might not necessarily rely on him as a go-to option in the post as much, because other guys can score, and he's such a good passer that I think that might be the best part of Xavier's offense, is him kicking the ball out to other players.
Snow, what do you – I want to – Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I just want to make something very clear. When Rick says Stainbrook's in his own world, the dude's in his own world.
Yeah.
Like, in more ways than one.
So when we talk, let's move on to D. Davis, one of Snow's favorite players. Brian, you've talked about D potentially leading the Big East in assists this year. What do you see as things that what are some points you think that we're going to see D improve in this year over maybe what we saw last year, where he was playing that weird hybrid 1/2 role with Samaje in the backcourt?
I just think you're going to see him be more comfortable all the time. I don't necessarily know that, you know, he's not going to be a 40% three-point shooter. He's still going to stay 36, 37%. He's not all of a sudden going to be dunking in traffic, but he's still going to be the best on-ball defender in the league, for the record, just like he was last year. And he's this year, now that A, he's going to have the ball more, and B, he's got guys who can make shots more consistently. He was second or third in the league in assists last year. He's probably going to lead the league in assists this year. And when your point guard does that, I mean, you got a chance to win a lot of basketball games.
Well, and the thing about D is having last year's offense was Samaje had to be a ball dominant player. They had to play that way. That's how Samaje played. And he was without a doubt their best chance of scoring on a given possession. So that's the way they played. Basically, they were relying on D to be a really good defensive player and a guy who could hopefully shoot at a high clip. He was honestly a kickout shooter last year on the offensive end. He didn't have the ball in his hands. He didn't have guys that he could play off of that he could make better by being a great passer. I mean, he did what he could by, like Brian said, being about third in assists on a team that couldn't shoot. So this year, he's a guy that is now playing with the ball in his hands all the time, and he basically has four guys around him most of the time that like to score, that want to score, that are going to be aggressive trying to score the basketball. He just looks so much more comfortable, especially when they go to live action and start scrimmaging, and he just gets to play. And it reminds me a lot more of the D. Davis I saw playing for Indiana Elite on the AAU circuit and playing his freshman year behind Mark and Two with a pretty good roster around him as a backup than it has the D. Davis we've seen the last two seasons.
Rick, you've described Miles Davis as maybe the most impressive player in practice thus far this season. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I think Miles has been excellent. And to be honest with you, he's going to be the starting two now. I don't think there's honestly not even a debate to be made. You know, there may or may not have been a game played at CentOS Center, and Miles may or may not have started at the two in that game and played the most minutes at the two in that game. And it makes sense. I mean, like, the more I watched practice, the more I thought, we've been saying this for so long that Remy's guaranteed to play 30 plus minutes a game. He's going to start. But the evidence hasn't been there in practice. Miles has been not by far the best player, but he has been by far the best two guard. And I would say right behind him would be Trayvon, which we get to in a minute as far as best player. But Miles has been consistent every single day. And the thing is, it's not even the fact that he's been shooting the ball so much better, which people were hoping he'd get back to after his struggles last year. It's the fact that he knows the defensive system so well, and he's a smart player, and he's improved mobily. His leg doesn't look like it's bothering him as much as far as his knee goes after he tore that MCL or meniscus or whatever it was before the beginning of last season. It never seemed like it really healed throughout the year. He was always kind of dragging it. He's moving a little bit better. He's always in the right position. And offensively, he knows everything. He's confident. He's talking to guys. He's been the leader of the group in practice. I mean, you can't say enough good things about the way the last month has gone for Miles Davis, and he deserves to be the starting two. And I think fans are going to be really impressed with what he's been, because honestly, the shooting again has been the least impressive part of what he's brought to practice. He's been beating guys off the dribble, and I think that's a huge thing, because he's a guy who's a smart passer. He's a willing passer. He's a smart passer. So if he's getting into the lane, that means defenses are going to inevitably have to collapse, and he's going to find other guys. And now you've got D, Miles, both passing the ball and getting to the lane. Their offense is hard to guard when those two guys are playing like they have been in practice.
Brian, moving on to Trayvon Blewett. You made some interesting points, I think, on the message board about his defense being a lot better than anticipated. What do you see as Trayvon's role on this team, and what's sort of the ceiling for him as a freshman on this particular Xavier squad?
I mean, it wouldn't shock me if he leads the team in scoring. Is that a ceiling? I don't know. But I think his role is he's going to make a lot of shots. He's going to get a lot of rebounds. And he's, surprisingly to me, going to be an adequate defender. Trayvon gets it done by being smart and being strong as opposed to being athletic. But he just does it. He knows how to get things done on the defensive end, at least to an adequate level. I mean, no one's going to confuse him with Lloyd Price or Justin Cage, but you're not embarrassed by having him out there either. So you combine that with just his ability to make shots and his understanding of how to play on offense, and he's going to provide a lot of things. And the key is he's not going to be asked to be the leading scorer. It's not going to be, hey, Trayvon, go out and be wonderful. It just may happen naturally and, I guess, organically, I guess you would say. And that's so much easier for a freshman than being counted on. Like, you know, maybe like Stanley Burrell was as a freshman.
Right.
It just gives
right.
him so much more freedom to be him.
And Rick, I noticed because I had seen them practice before the Brazil trip and then saw them a couple weeks ago. And it looked to me like Trayvon Blewett was one guy that really got it done as far as his individual workouts and working out in the weight room and so forth. He looked like a guy that was that had lost some weight, where he needed to lose some weight and it added muscle, and it showed in the way that he was just bouncing off guys and getting his shot in practice. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think the thing about Trayvon is the work is never done, because he's a guy that has the fat gene that he can put on 10, 15 pounds in a month like it's nothing, it seems like. You know, I mean, every time you see him, he might look like he has a different body, but the thing is he works so hard that I don't think it's going to be an issue, and he's done a great job of, even since the summer, like I think when he first got here or before he got to Xavier, he was really working on bulking up and getting stronger, and he came in looking pretty boxy but with a huge upper body, and he's really filled out. And in the last few months, I think he's really kind of reshaped that and become leaner and looked a little quicker. And obviously, when you sort of look at the time in which he finished his mile, he was among the top like three or four guys. I think it kind of shows you the level of his conditioning and how seriously he's taken that part of his game since he's arrived on campus, which is important for him because he's not the best athlete in the world, but he has great body control, and the fact that he's worked hard to get himself in sort of in great shape and reshape that body has meant that he does look like he's not and I think this is part of the reason he's been successful on defense, is he's not behind the other guys athletically. He can measure up, he can match up with them despite not being so athletically gifted just naturally.
All right, let's finish up the probable starting five with Jalen Reynolds. The rumor from the hypothetical game that may or may not have occurred is that Jalen had a game a little bit to forget. Were we too quick this summer because of the way he dominated practice to say that he was ready to make a leap this season? Given the fact that really his role last year did not become paramount until February?
I think one thing with Jalen is, it's sort of like with what Brian said about Trayvon and his role as a freshman, that you're not going to have to rely on him. It's the same thing with Jalen. They don't need him to be the best scorer on this team. He's capable of doing that. He can be the best player on this team on any given night, but he's not going to be the best player every single night. And it's good that they don't need him to, because what they need him to be focused on is just playing as hard as he possibly can. He's a guy that is, when the lights come on, he's going to be the best athlete on the court more often than not. And he needs to let those instincts take over, because he might be in the wrong place defensively a lot of times, but he might also recover by making a block from behind a guy or something just off his natural athleticism. And they understand that, so they give him a leash, they let him play. But the thing that you start to see come out when you get deeper into practice and you start playing these exhibitions and he's having to think a little bit more is, he, you know, he's having some trouble picking up the system, and he still is making the same mistakes that he was making last year. In a lot of cases, he's not as advanced as a guy like James Farr, who has now picked it up and is a veteran and knows where everyone should be. Jalen's still right there with the freshman and figuring out where he should be and making mistakes. And I think that hurts him, and sometimes he overthinks. So they really just have to focus on getting him to play hard and lead the Big East in rebounding. That should be his goal. Regardless of what else he does on the court, he has to be the best rebounder in the conference.
Snow, among the bench guys, the probable bench guys, who sticks out to you as somebody that maybe will have a big role to play on this team?
I would say the two would be James Farr and Brandon Randolph. With Farr, it's just he can bounce between the four and the five. He brings a little bit different aspect with his shooting. And also, he's a really good rebounder and shot blocker because of how just enormous and long he is. Then with Randolph, he didn't play well in the scrimmage, allegedly. But he's had a really good summer and fall, and I think he's going to compete for the backup one, and I think he will win the backup one minutes before it's all said and done. And then he's also making shots at a pretty good level, and he's tough, he's athletic. And if you remember last year, for the first month, he was really pretty good when he was getting consistent minutes, and then D no longer had a concussion and those minutes went away. and Brandon went away.
Right.
And concussions can do that to you. But at the end of the day, I think Brandon's really going to step up this year. Then, of course, Remy Abel's going to have his role because he's just different. He's 6'4". He's athletic. He may drive you crazy because he'll forget where he's supposed to be on defense sometimes. But still, he's great in transition. He can guard the ball, and he brings versatility on the wing.
Yeah, and Snow nailed it. Like, the thing about Remy Abel, I don't want to sound too down on him because, like, end of the day, if you went out and played one-on-one basketball or were just playing like pickup basketball, Remy Abel would be right up there with the top players on this team. He's a really good on-ball defender. He's tough to guard one-on-one when he's driving to the rim. He's great in transition. He can knock down a three-point goal. There's a lot to like about him, and he brings tons of energy to practice. He's always talking. He plays really hard. The problem is he just doesn't know what he's doing enough to be a leader and to help other guys and be that veteran presence. And it's also going to cost him minutes. I mean, Miles has been much better than him, and a lot of it has been due to Miles' knowledge of the system and his confidence with what he's doing on both ends. So I think that's going to be one thing to interesting to watch, is how well Remy sort of fits into the system and figures things out as we go. Because one of the biggest things about Xavier's pack line is they have to be in help position. It has to be a defense built from the inside out. And Remy's a guy who likes to play in the passing lanes and likes to start out instead of in. And it doesn't work when one guy's doing one thing and the other four are doing another. It looks bad at times, and it leads to easy buckets, and the coaches just won't accept that. So he's got to make sure he shores up a few of those things if he's going to see the minutes that we thought he might entering the season. But a lot of the reasons he's not going to play 30 plus minutes is because Miles and Brandon have been so much better than they were a year ago.
Well, I think the last thing that I wanted to hit on before we move on to our next topic, which will be one close to Snow's heart, is to talk about McKinde London and Edmund Sumner, because we're getting closer and closer to decisions having to be made about what these guys are going to do this year. Edmund's still dealing with the tendonitis issue. McKinde, you know, the question has always been, is he too raw? Would he benefit from having a redshirt year? Do you guys get a sense of which way of where things are going to stand with these two guys?
Well, first of all, I have a clip here. This was Chris Mack talking about Edmund Sumner on Lance McAllister's show the other night and the timetable for him to return.
Well, Edmund, you know, is one of our most talented guards. You know, the thing about Edmund is he's been stricken with tendonitis here over the preseason, hasn't really practiced a ton, but he is itching to get going. And I would say give him about, you know, 2 to 3 more weeks and he'll be full speed and full go, Lance, and will rejoin us at just about the time we're starting our season.
Yeah, right there you hear from what the vibe I've gotten from talking to sources and what Chris Mack just said right there, it sounds like they still expect Edmund to be a part of this team. I don't think that puts him too far behind to where he couldn't be a contributor, you know, within a month or two, because I do think he brings a playmaking ability and some size at the guard position that they don't otherwise have. He's a smart player. He has a lot of feel, and he can really break guys down off the bounce and get his own shot. So I think that especially if you were to have like an injury to a Remy Abel or someone like that, God forbid, I think it's kind of a comfort to know that you would still have Edmund Sumner there as a potential possibility. Now, with McKinde, I think he will probably redshirt still, as long as he's okay with doing that. Yeah, I think he's really excited about this season, and he doesn't, you know, I don't know if he's going to be completely bought in on redshirting, but ultimately I think it would be the best thing for him.
Yeah, I mean, McKinde needs to redshirt. Now, I don't think the staff will make him.
Right, exactly.
And I don't know if he's going to agree with my assessment, but I think certainly he needs to redshirt. So that'll be interesting to see how that fun conversation goes before the start of the season that the staff, I'm sure, will have with him. With Edmund, I think in theory they think he's going to start practicing soon, whatever the heck soon means. And then realistically, they hope he can play by Thanksgiving. I'm going to take the over on that one. The kid hasn't done anything for 3 months. He hasn't had contact yet. So when he does start practicing, and, you know, I guess theoretically he could start practicing today, tomorrow, whenever, you know, it's going to take 2-3 weeks, not to mention he hasn't done anything in the system. He's not going to have a clue what he's doing. And when you combine that with being physically immature, relatively speaking, to the rest of the team, it's just tough for me to see him being game ready by game four. So I would take a little bit of the over on Thanksgiving and maybe put it towards closer to, you know, middle of December, but we'll see. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see when he can get back, but they certainly are planning for him to be back.
Okay, well, I think probably the next topic we should discuss is talk a little bit about Big East Media Day. We'll talk to Shannon and then we'll allow Snow to go off on Tom Crean when we have lots of time to do that. The Big East Media Day was held at Madison Square Garden a couple weeks ago. The Villanova Wildcats are ranked as the preseason number one, followed by Georgetown. Villanova got 9 of the 10 media votes. St. John's third, Xavier fourth, followed by, in order, Providence, Seton Hall, Butler, and Marquette, joint seventh, Creighton ninth, and DePaul in their the traditional DePaul position. Guys, looking at this poll, you know, what are your takeaways from looking at it? Who's ranked properly? Who's too high? Who's too low? Is Xavier right? Start with you, Rick.
Well, I had to write the Big East preview for the Scout preview magazine. I don't know if that's come out yet or when that comes out. But my top five was Villanova, Georgetown, Xavier, Providence, St. John's. You can call me biased if you want because I cover Xavier. But my thing is this. St. John's has not proven that they're going to win with Steve Lavin coaching them at all, regardless of how much talent they have. I don't know that they have more talent than they did last year, and they weren't able to do that. So I don't know why people assume that they will this year. You know, the Big East coaches had Providence at fifth. I think Buckets is really good. I think it was Bryce Cotton was what drove that team. But during the season, LaDante Henton was really good and also played a huge role in their success. So I think they'll be a little bit better than the coaches expect them to be. But for the most part, I mean, I think they've got things pretty much about right.
I think Marquette's being undervalued a little bit. I think they were just chemistry wise screwed up last year.
Really?
And I don't want to blame Buzz Williams for that. I just think it was Buzz had worn out his welcome with the team.
You're not worried about their size at all?
When they get loose, I saw them practice a couple, like a week ago. I was in Milwaukee. I watched them practice and they're small. But when they get Luke Fisher back, which they will, that changes things. You're talking a 6'10 mobile kid who can score that not many teams in college basketball are going to have. Now, they're not going to have much behind him, and that does worry me, but I think Marquette's going to be better than people giving them credit for. And Matt Carlino's in his 38th year of college basketball. And, like, by the time you turn 50 and you're if your body holds up like Carlino's has, you've played so much that, like, you just know how to score and you can not be guarded. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's tough to argue with Villanova as number one. I mean, I think they're kind of streets ahead of everybody else. I think X could – I mean, I think X could challenge Georgetown for second place.
Xavier should be in second. That they are the second best team in the league. Now they have to prove that they're the second best team in the league, but on paper they are.
Yeah, there's just so many question marks with this roster, but at the same time, when you look at what everyone else has as far as question marks as well, it's like there's not really excuses. There's still enough talent on this roster to finish in the top three, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it strikes me that none of the teams that are in that, you know, you had that sort of peer group that they were in last year where everybody just beat the heck out of each other all season long. This year, it seems like there's a little bit more. It seems like Xavier's closer to the top teams than they are to the sort of middle class of this league. I mean, I think X comes into this year and you would have to think there's some daylight between them and Providence and Seton Hall and Butler and Marquette. And I would look for X to do a little bit better on the road this season than they did last year. And I think X, you know, 12 wins in this league is realistic. And I think that's actually what you projected, right, Snow? 12-6. And I think that's doable. And assuming they get the job done against their non-conference slate, that should put them in a pretty good spot come March.
If they don't get the job done against the non-conference slate, they got bigger problems than winning in the league.
That's true. There's no way to get around that. You know, and that brings us to a question that was posed on the message board regarding two things. I want to the first question was from RC 42 East. This is a great question because it's something we talked about last year a lot. Last season, the team was often stalled by slow starts. Do we expect this to persist this season, or do we think the team will have more attack mentality coming out of the locker room? I guess that remains to be seen because they haven't really played yet, and in the hypothetical exhibition, they didn't get off to a particularly fast start. Is there anything X can do to fix that problem, or is it just a matter of they got to just go out and make shots early?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the biggest thing last year was like everyone was making it a thing where they didn't play hard enough or didn't come out with energy. And it's like, well, they didn't make shots because they're not a very good offensive team and they don't have guys who can make shots. And when you go on the road in an unfamiliar building, sometimes it's harder to make shots. And that's kind of where things were this year. I don't think they'll have as many slow starts because I think they'll make more shots. Although you bring up an interesting point about a game that may or may not have happened this weekend at the CentOS Center.
Yeah.
But in that first half, what happened? They didn't make shots.
Right. Hypothetically.
Right. But it is worth pointing out that, you know, they still had a hypothetical slow start after there was no doubt that there was a trend of them last year. I'm not dismissing that fact at all. I don't know what you can attribute that to other than the guys have to make shots, because I didn't think it was like their defense was terrible or, you know, sometimes they did get a little out of sorts with turnovers. And I think that might be a problem for this year's team because they're still very young and they're probably going to turn the ball over a decent amount still.
And in fact, it seemed like in the middle sections of the season, especially, Coach Mack kind of just conceded the fact that the team would never get off to a fast start offensively. And that's when he started starting Eric Stenger at the four to try and get a little bit more energy at the beginnings of games, especially on defense. So, it's tough to say. But the other question, and I'll direct this one to you, Snow, because it relates to one of your favorite subjects. Since the out-of-conference schedule is a little lighter this year, do you see the staff playing around with the lineup a bit early?
No, I don't see them playing around with the lineup. I think they're going to go with who they think's the best and treat every game like they're playing Kentucky. Now, they're not playing Kentucky. They're playing Kentucky School for the Blind and Deaf. But they're going to treat every game like they're playing Kentucky. So I don't think you'll see any experimentation.
Well, that being said, it's going to be the same as last year, whereas you're up in some of these early games, except there's going to be a whole lot more of them that you're probably up big in them. And you're going to play more guys. I mean, guys like Brandon Randolph and even James Farr, you know, played a lot more minutes early in the season than they did once they got to conference play because they had big leads. And that's going to be the same way. So you might see more of with the young guys, you might see more of J.P. McKeera, Edmund Sumner when he's back, Larry Austin early in the season. You're going to see them late, but that's strictly going to be because they have the lead.
Yeah. For the record, the toughest team they play in the non-conference is Stephen F. Austin, who's really good. People can talk about UC, Missouri, Alabama, and whatever bums they're playing in Anaheim, but Stephen F. Austin's going to be the best non-conference team they play.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough game for this team. Even being at home early in the season, I think it's a tight turnaround from a Friday to a Monday game. That is not a gimme, and that's going to be one that Stephen F. Austin's going to have circled on their calendar, because that team doesn't get a whole lot of opportunities to get marquee out of conference games, and they're in a league where one slip up knocks them out of the NCAA tournament. So I expect that to be, as Pete Gillen would say, a wall. But the rest of the games ought to be pretty manageable.
Tell BJ to shut Dana's down early that Saturday and Sunday.
I don't think he's going to do that.
All right. Well, that seems like as good a time as any to bring in our guest tonight. She is the Xavier beat writer for the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's my pleasure to welcome in Shannon Russell. Shannon, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. First of all, we want to start, Shannon. We mentioned it at the top of the podcast, but one of the more special sports moments in Cincinnati history occurred this weekend, and that was the Mount St. Joseph girls game that included Lauryn Hill and her first collegiate game, as she likes to phrase it. Just what was that? I mean, we talked a little bit about it at practice today, but what was that experience like for you, just getting the opportunity to cover something like that?
It was It was amazing. I have never seen in CenTos Center that full, 10,250 plus. I would say there's more than that there. It filling up the stands and the seats and the aisleways in some areas. And then there was 116 members of the media that were there as well. So, but, you know, Lauren is just such a different person than I've ever covered before. She's just very upbeat, and she really inspired people that were there. It was, you know, kind of an emotional day, as you would expect, as she got her first basket and then she got the last basket. But it was just that I've never kind of covered anything like that quite, that same situation in all my years of covering sports. So it was just real poignant and touching and uplifting all at the same time. So it was a great experience.
Well, I guess going from the sublime to the ridiculous, you were also on the scene for Musketeer Madness. First of all, you got to tell us about the Mac family's rap performance. What was your how did you think it ranked with his Slim Shady entrance a couple years ago? And you know, what was your takeaway from that?
I think it was his best one yet. It was funny. You know, I knew beforehand what they were going to do. And I had some pictures of the girls, Lainey and Haley backstage as they were getting ready for the big performance. And so I knew what they were going to look like when they came out. But I think for this year's Musketeer Madness, and I said this in the blog, it just seemed like a lot of fun. Like the guys were having a lot of fun. Chris had a lot of fun. He called everyone up on the stage to kind of, to help him play out the rendition of the Beastie Boys song, Paul Revere. And he made it fun for everyone there that was watching. So I'd say it ranks up there as one of the top ones he's ever done.
Well, and of course, there was a lot tweeted about all these different intros. Who else stood out in the intro line? Because in the past, we've only had like Stainbrook coming into Wrecking Ball and juggling a couple of basketballs, and Eric Stanger waving an American flag. Who else stood out during the intros this year?
Hold on, Rick. Are you forgetting the Landon Amos introduction last year?
Oh, yeah, when Landon Amos did the Ray Lewis introduction.
Yeah, I mean,
Landon Amos first walk on to get kicked off the team, by the way.
I would say the one that made me laugh the most was Andrew Mitchell, because he came out and started to do a dance, and then it just kept going and going and going, and you're just kind of waiting for someone to maybe pull him off the stage or something. And it got to the point where everyone was laughing because he just kept dancing. He just wasn't stopping. He was just having a great time up there.
Hey, it's Andrew Mitchell. He's a walk-on. That's his one shining moment. He's got to milk it. I mean, if you're getting a crowd reaction, you got to go with it.
I know. And, Matt came out with Trey Couch. That was nice. They came out together and were introduced together. And I'm trying to think of who else was like really funny. Like there's a lot of guys that did the X, of course, and some guys just wave. But Mackenzie London came out with a microphone and started to do a rap, which I thought was entertaining and gutsy for a freshman. So that was one of the better ones as well.
Hey, Shannon, when you think about practice you've seen numerous times this summer, whether it be before Brazil or now leading up into the hypothetical scrimmage that may or may not have occurred, and then the actual scrimmage that will occur this weekend, who has stood out to you? Maybe let's start by talking about among the newcomers. Who stood out to you as particularly impressive or better than you expected, or somebody you think will make an impact this year?
Well, you know, I knew that Trayvon Blewett was going to come in with maybe the most college ready, and I don't think I've been disappointed at all in that. I think he's got the physique of a college player, and he's got a really great touch from outside as well. But you know, he's a big guy, so he can score inside too. So I haven't seen obviously anyone play in a game situation, but from what I've seen in practice, I think that he has just done an excellent job. They've all done well in certain points, but of course you've got the freshman moments where, they've turned the ball over. They haven't kind of gotten to play down or anything like that. So, I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag, but I would say Trayvon would be probably the one that stood out the most.
Overall, Shannon, I think, you know, one of the more interesting storylines coming into practice has been the guard minutes. And we've talked about that a lot on the podcast, on my message board, and how those are going to shake out. And I think a lot of people had kind of thought, will Miles Davis, will Brandon Randolph think about transferring in the offseason? Will they even see minutes in their sophomore year after playing a decent amount as freshmen? I think both of those guys have been two of the more impressive players in practice and the way that they have improved. And one of the more interesting that I think you have written on for the Enquirer recently was the Catching Up with Brandon Randolph article you did, where he called the way he played last year timid. Those were his words. And he said, you know, he missed his dad and his friends at home in California. What has been your take on, one, after you talk to him, where do you think he's at mentally? And two, what's your take on how Brandon's looked in practice? And do you see a difference from the way he played last year and the way he interacted with his teammates?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. You know, Brandon, I think he dealt with so much of that homesickness and just kind of being in a place where, I mean, he never had seen snow before he was here. And he said he just, you know, wouldn't think about it. And he would throw on his flip-flops to go get something to eat. And he'd go outside and there'd be snow. And he'd be like, oh, man, I didn't think about this because he's from California. But his minutes just dwindled there. He said he wasn't playing within himself. He wasn't playing his game. And as you said, timid. And I think that's so different now. I think that he's come back. He's got a year under his belt. And he's more confident. And he's just done a really good job. Like we were talking earlier today, he's just been impressive in the way that he carries himself and the way that he's able to do the things he needs to do at practice. I mean, he doesn't look like a freshman anymore to me. And just to kind of go off that with Miles, he has probably been one of people that's impressed me the most, just knowing how the end of last season was very difficult for him, and he just missed so many three-pointers, and, you know, it was just very frustrating for everyone. So, you know, I kind of wondered where he would fit into things, but he has just shown great resolve. He's been great. His defense looks better. His shooting has been good. He's been one of the better players that have been out there. So with both those guys, with Brandon and with Miles, I think that they made that big, important leap at just the right time, you know, that huge growth spurt as a college player. And so I think we're going to see a lot of that this season.
Well, I couldn't agree more on both guys. And one of the things with Brandon Randolph, I think they're asking him to play a lot of backup point guard minutes right now. And I think that he might be the backup point guard when D. Davis comes out of the game. And one thing I've kind of noticed from Brandon is he is not a extrovert by nature. He doesn't talk a whole lot, but he has made a concerted effort to at least try when he's out there running the team. He tries to talk to his teammates. He tries to be a more vocal guy, even when it's not positive, even when it's getting on a guy a little bit for something they did wrong. He's doing that. And last year, I don't think he would have ever done that. And I found your article particularly interesting because I thought his quote saying that he played timid was a lot of times those quotes are such cliches just to get through the interview. They don't really give us what they're not really thinking and self-assessing their play. But timid would be the exact word I would use to describe Brandon Randolph after like the sixth or seventh game of the season last year. That's the way he played, was timid. So I thought it was interesting that that's what he said he did and that he clearly has tried to kind of counteract that this year with his at least his performance in practice.
Yeah, you know, I didn't talk to him very much last year, if at all, because he just wasn't a big factor in certain games. Obviously, towards, you know, the middle of the season on, like he didn't have a big role. And, you know, so I didn't sit down to interviews with him. So I didn't really know what was going through his mind at that time. So to be able to talk to him this summer and him to go back and say that and be candid about it was actually kind of refreshing that he said that. And as you said, yeah, he's out there like telling people what to do, and he's got that confidence where he's in the system, he's been there, and he can tell other people what to do as well. So, you know, I think that's going to be huge for him this year.
Shannon, another question that I had for you was to ask you what do you think about as far as differences between this year's team and in previous years? We talked about the size of the team, top to bottom of the roster, and just better jump shooting. Are those things you've noticed as well as you've observed the team in practice, or are there other things that you think are definitely different about this team than maybe the last 2 years?
I think, well, the first thing is clearly just looking at the who you have, the depth is different, the talent is different. I think those are the two things that just are remarkable right off the bat. Having just a more consistently big front line, more guys there, has made the kind of the makeup of practices different, the field different, and just having, like, you know, actually having more guys at every position has just been kind of a refreshing change from years past. You know, as far as specifics, it's hard to say right, you know, this early kind of what to is that different, I guess. You know, I still have time to kind of study that a little bit more, but, you know, I think they're still learning what they need to do, the younger guys, and going through some of the early season rigors of learning plays and that kind of thing. So, check with me back on that question here in about a month.
Yeah. Hey, Shannon, I have one more. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I was just going to say that the point she brings up about the depth across the board is important in practice, because last year, I think, you saw walk-ons playing an important role during drills or live action. And this year it's like, you've got too many guys. I mean, you got a couple extra guys. You can go five on five competitively in every drill or any live action you want to do. And you're going to have five guys that are, or 10 guys on the court that are competing for minutes. It's not a Tim Stainbrook and Tim Stainbrook's actually pretty good, by the way, but he's not in there playing in the important live action during practice. You know, it is guys that are trying to earn minutes every single moment that they're doing something live. And I think that's important.
Shannon, so this is my last point. Okay. So first of all, I want to know what you think of the new floor. And then I want to request respectfully that you embark on a all the President's Men style investigative journalism spree to determine whether or not friend of the podcast Mario Mercurio rigged the design the floor contest on GoXavier.com so his own proposed design would win.
I can't speak to that last point, but I will say that I like the floor. I like it. I think it looks good. You know, I've seen it, you know, several times now, and every time I think it looks pretty good. I don't know. What do you guys think of it?
I think it shows really well on TV, and I was even thinking that during the Lauryn Hill game. I was like, that looks cool, and it looks cool when you're doing something like this for the entire city that's not Xavier related. It looks kind of cool to have the skyline out there. I think it shows really well on TV. I personally prefer it. It sounds like Dan doesn't like it a whole lot. I don't know.
Oh, I think it's fine. I mean, but I don't think it's going to make a when you watch it on TV. Part of the issue is that the Fox score line covers most of it, so you can't even see it for the most part. Mm. I noticed that during the Pacers Cavs game that they televised a couple weeks ago.
It's funny because I think I posted on Twitter a while before the floor even went down what it was going to look like, and there was just people really had an opinion about it one way or the other. You know, a lot of people thought, I love it, it looks great, you know, we're representing the city, and some people are like, well, that's what Memphis has, they just took it from Memphis, and, you know, I don't like the colors and the stain and all that kind of stuff. But I think at the end of the day, you know, it's just a floor, they're not going to keep it forever that way, and for now I think it's fine.
Yeah, I'm with you. Snow, are you still alive?
Not dead yet.
Okay, just checking. Shannon, thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always. Check out, you got anything big coming up for the beginning of the season here planned for the Enquirer coverage?
Well, I mean, as far as this week, of course, we're going to have a preview of the exhibition and coverage of the exhibition and analysis of the exhibition. So that's the next thing on the list.
And follow her live tweets on Twitter, SL Russell, correct?
That's the real exhibition and not the hypothetical exhibition.
That may or may not have happened.
Right.
But right, Shannon did not get kicked out of it, so that's good. What?
Hypothetically
kicked out. All right, Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it. Okay, great.
All right, good stuff from Shannon as always. That nearly brings us to the end of the shenanigans here on this 56th episode of the podcast. But first, we want to discuss my friend and yours, Tom Crean, and some of the things going on there. First of all, I want to know, I don't necessarily know if Tom Crean needs to be fired or not, especially for the things that are going on right now. But since everyone has their pitchforks out and their torches ready, Snow, what are the options for the angry mob over there in Bloomington? What can they do with a coach who has a $12 million buyout? And who can you get and pay after that fact? And especially right now, 2 weeks before the season starts.
Well, the thing is even if you can get $12 million, And I guess theoretically, like if Mark Cuban decides like that he wants to donate $12 million, they could to buy him out. You're not going to, because you can't really justify that kind of money. I mean, with the way higher education's complaining for money to pay $12 million to at a public school for a guy not to do his job, that's a tough sell.
Oh, Charlie Weiss is getting paid by like five different institutions right now.
Yeah, but at least like Notre Dame's private, and, you know, that was like 10 calls and they're not in a budget crunch and it doesn't have state funds involved and all that crap. I don't think they can do anything right now. I think it's ride out the storm and just kind of see what happens in the season. So I'd say right now people can get their little Twitter outrage, which they love to have. Stand for something on Twitter, folks. Makes you cool. I promise. And, you know, they do what they do.
Snow, the one thing that cannot be denied is that there's been a ton of incidents that have occurred at Indiana. I agree with you 100% that a basketball, football, whatever coach cannot be held responsible for what 19-year-old idiots do. But when it happens a ton of times in a short period, does that change the score for you, or is it still just sort of what's the coach supposed to do?
Dan, if I take you and your 12 best friends as a sophomore in high school, how many of you drank?
Sophomore in high school or college?
College.
Sorry. all of us but one, I think.
Okay. How many smoked weed?
I'm not going to answer that one.
I would say that proves my point pretty clearly. Why are we expecting athletes to be any different?
Well, and here's the best part of the Greg Doyle column. If you didn't read it, there is Greg Doyle, the Indy Star now columnist, wrote a column that was talking about how 6 out of 13 players got cited for different things, and they were all related to drinking or smoking. And he says, this isn't a problem. This is an epidemic, and it falls on Crean for two reasons. I'm not even going to read the two reasons, because all I care about is that he called it an epidemic. And my point is what's the epidemic? Is the epidemic that there's 6 out of 13 that are smoking and drinking? Because if so, that's a hell of a ratio for a college basketball program. Tom Green is running a Saints program over there. I mean, that is impressive stuff if only 6 out of 13 are drinking and smoking, if that's Greg Doyle's point. The point's that too many people are getting caught, I agree. What the hell are you doing as an IU basketball player in Bloomington that you're getting caught drinking and driving or smoking weed or any of – how are you getting caught in Bloomington doing this stuff as an IU player? People are out to help you.
This is the thing.
The campus is filled with people who are trying to help you.
This is the thing with Greg Doyle, and I feel like this him moving from CBS to the Indy Star is such a negative, because it's like I liken it to Johnny Appleseed. If Johnny Appleseed had stayed put in Ohio and just planted his apple trees there, there'd be a beautiful grove of apple trees, but the rest of the country would have been denied delicious apples. And if Greg Doyle is in Indianapolis and he's purveying all his scorching hot takes there instead of to a national audience, it seems like the people in Indiana are just going to be spoiled for strong takes, and the rest of us are going to be devoid of strong takes. We might have to read like Jay Mariotti or something. So
never mention that name.
So Greg Doyle, don't hide your lantern under a barrel, as the Bible says. Come back to us. Come back to us. Don't focus your energy on simply one basketball program and one beleaguered coach, when there are so many college athletes that you can accuse of being part of this nationwide epidemic of college drinking, which never incidentally existed prior to what, 5-10 years ago, I guess.
Well, yeah. And then today the Gary Parrish column comes out, and there's been plenty of other media piling on here. And Gary Parrish says, quotes an unnamed source close to the program that says there is definitely a disconnect between Tom and the players. And I think this just goes back to the whole point of why you shouldn't be a to everyone you meet and make everyone hate you, because when it comes time for there to be an opportunity to throw you under the bus and try to burn down your life, everyone's going to jump at the chance to do so. And that's what you're going to continue to see from the media covering Tom Crean.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Tom hasn't made a lot of friends, nor has he tried. and that's going to come back to haunt him now. And it is what it is. I mean, it's just so much of this. It's like people are getting like so high and mighty. Like what happened with Devin Davis and Emmett Holt is it's not a tragedy because no one died, but it's a terrible thing because someone got seriously hurt. But to act like Emmett Holt was drinking, that's terrible. He had one beer. One beer. 0.025 is literally one beer. Last week, the day after that event, I had one beer with the Illinois staff and one beer with the Dayton staff the night before they might or might not have played in Indianapolis. I drove home. Does that make me a terrible person because no one jumped out in front of my car? I mean, it's just like people are just
you're a terrible person, but not because of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But so, I mean, it's like people just love to go off and feel like how morally sound they are and then like go tell their wife, like, hey, I went on Twitter and told people how outraged I am. That gets me points. Like, go shake someone's hand before a football game or something. That's sportsmanship. I don't know.
This is just one of those things. I mean, it's not even worth the energy to get pissed off about it. I find, you know, when the New York Times is writing an article about the Tallahassee Police Department systematically covering up criminal investigations involving Florida State football players, that bugs me. That's something worth getting a little bit hacked off about. But this business about the fact that a few Indiana players have coincided, you know, and these drug tests, by the way, the failed drug test by the other two players, those tests were failed 3 or 4 months ago. Somebody leaked that contemporaneous with this latest incident in order to take a pot shot at Tom Crean, which goes back to Rick's point about why you don't want to alienate every single person you deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
But Dan, I don't know you just used, but it was a really big word and I'm going to need to Google that to figure out what the hell it meant. But I mean, like this whole thing, and you were going on whatever, like they were going to announce it. It's just no one announces in a suspension over the summer, because what are you suspending a kid from? Like people are like, why didn't we know earlier? Well, we're not letting them out of weightlifting and off-season conditioning. That's not a punishment. You know, like you can't condition. That'll teach them. Dan, I want to go off on something real quick. You talked about the Florida State situation and the police and all this. Why are people holding Jimbo Fisher responsible for how the Tallahassee police acted? I'm completely baffled by this.
Because Jimbo Fisher is an idiot.
I think that Jimbo Fisher
Rick?
But
what's he supposed to do?
He is really staked his colors to the mast on this in a way that I find kind of embarrassing. I don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other, which goes against the very fiber of this podcast.
Yeah, that's not a hot take.
But no, I ask you this. What is he supposed to do?
He doesn't have to do anything. And I know the specific case you're talking about, but the reason people are taking shots at him is because he's been an idiot through this as well. He's starting to say like ESPN is the reason that people are covering his players like they should be covered after the things that they're doing. And I mean,
allegedly,
what did they do?
Allegedly doing. But I mean,
Like, why am I supposed to believe someone I don't know versus if I'm Jimbo Fisher versus someone I do know? And to expect me to do that is mind boggling. What's he supposed to do?
Well, the whole Jameis Winston
mouth shut.
The whole Jameis Winston case wasn't exactly Des Wells. I mean, it was a police department that screwed up evidence. It wasn't.
But that's not Jimbo. All he can go on is what he knows. He knows Jameis says he didn't do it. He knows the cops say he didn't do it.
That's fine. But you don't have to rub it in everyone's face that we're the moral upstanding citizens of the world.
What's he supposed to say?
Just shut up. Just don't answer the question. There's ways around it. You don't have to
answering questions. He's being an asshole. He's avoiding the questions. He's avoiding the tough questions. He won't do this. We're the media. We're great.
Clearly, this isn't going anywhere, so this is probably a good time to wrap it up. You've been listening to the 56th edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Brian and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.